Congressman DeFazio, thank you so much for joining us today. Does single-payer health insurance have any chance of making it through Congress, and do you support it?
I want to move toward universal health insurance. I want to see everybody in America have a good basic package of health insurance, and I think we have an opportunity to do that. No, it's not going to be single-payer. We're not going to do away with the insurance plans that 160 million Americans have today, who have private insurance through their employers. What the president has sketched out and what I think is a realistic approach is to improve that system, introduce competition into it, drive down costs, and then provide for a public plan option. That is that, you know, we're headed toward an idea that every American will have to have health insurance. The government will help you pay for it if you're very poor. And that there would be a public plan option, that is a plan sponsored by the government that would be, a low-cost alternative that would compete with the private plans. The private health insurance industry is going absolutely nuts over this, saying it's a non-starter. The Republicans have gone nuts over it, saying, look, it'll be less expensive. People will gravitate toward it. That'll move us toward a single-payer system. Well, if that's true, then so be it. I mean, we need to get the cost down. I don't believe it's going to have that much impact, because a lot of people will have insurance that is better than that through their employer, and they can keep that. We would also introduce competition into the health insurance industry for the first time. Most people don't know that the health insurance, all insurance, is exempt from antitrust law. I want to subject the entire industry to antitrust law. I've been proposing that for 23 years. Finally, my proposal seems to be getting a couple of legs. The industry is obviously adamantly opposed. Consumers Union says that would save Americans $40 to $50 billion in insurance premiums, not just health care, but homeowners insurance, car insurance, life insurance, every line of insurance. They're all exempt from antitrust law. So I think the president's moving us in the right direction, and it's going to be a very heavy lift to get what he wants, to get a public plan option, to level the playing field with the private insurance companies. And, that's if we can do that, it'll be tremendous for the future of the country. But it's going to be very hard.
Yeah, he said recently that if it's going to happen, it's going to have to happen this summer, while I guess his popularity remains high. Do you think he has a chance of getting it through this summer?
Well, I just came from a Democratic caucus, and there's 40 to 50 moderate to conservative Democrats who are saying there's no way they can support a public plan option, that they just want this all to be based in private health insurance. So we got some work to do just to get the votes here in the House, because we're probably not going to get hardly any, if any, Republican votes for this. I think it's going to be a lot like the Medicare debate in the 70s, where not a single Republican supported it, and we don't have as big a majority now as we did back then. And so it's going to be tough, but the Populist Caucus met this morning, and we're very supportive of a public plan option, and we also want to take away the antitrust exemption from the insurance industry. So, we're going to throw our weight, whatever that's worth, into the debate.
What do you think nominee Sonia Sotomayor would bring to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think she would bring an extraordinary amount of experience to the court. I mean, one of the most judicially experienced and tried judges, at least in recent history, over many, many years. I don't get a vote there, so I'm not fully versed on, the history of all the Supreme Court nominees, but I think she would be a tremendous addition to the court.
You're chairman of the House Subcommittee on Highways and Transit. How's it doing on its plan to craft a bill to reduce our dependence on foreign oil?
Well, once every 6 years, we write a transportation, surface transportation policy for the country that covers the whole national highway network, roads, bridges, highways, and our transit systems. We've pretty much been kind of just building on the legacy of the Eisenhower era, the building of the interstate system with a few bells and whistles, and transit was added in sort of as an afterthought, about 20 years ago. And every 6 years we fight over what percent transit will get and what percent highways will get. We want to take a new approach. We want to move toward what we call least cost transportation planning. Look at the problems America has: moving freight, moving people, congestion, wasted fuel, wasted time, and have our states and our major metropolitan areas develop plans to solve those problems, and do it in a mode neutral way. they're not going to say, well, 80% of your money is highway money. So if you've got a big congestion problem, you're just going to have to build highways through downtown Portland. Probably not going to happen. Instead, give Portland the flexibility to spend the money across modes, you know, whether it's commuter rail or more light rail or streetcars, bus rapid transit, or yeah, maybe some improvements, you know, in on ramps, off ramps, metering, smart, intelligent transportation solutions, things like that. But we also have to look at the condition. We're losing our legacy at the same time. I mean, the system we built out is important and phenomenal, and it's fallen apart. I mean, the bridge that fell down in Minnesota was just, you know, sort of, you know, a warning sign. We've got 160,000 bridges on the national highway system that are either functionally obsolete, meaning they have a very high rate of accident, even death because of their design, and they're, you know, they're over capacity, or 60,000 bridges that are actually structurally deficient. That is, they're weight limited, and, you know, will ultimately, you know, go the same place that the bridge in Minnesota went if we don't deal with them. Highway surfaces are in miserable condition. So our priorities are going to be on moving people more efficiently in a mode-neutral way, providing more options for people, and maintaining and bringing up to standard the system we already have. And then thirdly, the administration has asked, and I'm thrilled to be involved in it, that we include a high-speed rail title, which would be the first time. We've always bifurcated and said, oh, well, rail is over there and highways and transit are over there. No, we need an integrated transportation system, and they're actually asking that we include high-speed rail in this bill. We haven't completed that section yet, but I've got big ideas on you know, to move us toward a system of a national high-speed rail system, and I'm hoping to get the administration to support that.
So you think there's a good likelihood or a fair likelihood that we'll have a high-speed rail line through Oregon?
We were one of the first six designated high-speed rail corridors. I was involved in that back in the early 90s. There has been a very meager amount of federal investment in our corridor as well as the others. President Obama did put $8 billion into the stimulus package to devote to high-speed rail. I'm encouraging Oregon to apply for some of those funds. They're developing a new plan which would avoid the congested UP route up through Portland and bring the train around on an alternate route on the old Oregon Electric line, and then work with Washington State to see what we can do up there in terms of double tracking in some congested areas. So I would hope that you know, we'd be near the top of the list. Obviously, there are areas with higher concentrations of population that'll be vying for this. California's got a $10 billion bond issue they're putting up to move toward a dedicated high-speed rail. And then the only rail that is owned by the government, the actual rail bed, which makes it easier to move trains quickly if you own the rail bed, because then you can make the improvements, is in the Northeast Corridor. So
right, New York to Boston already.
Yeah, so what I want to do is plan a national system. Look at the 11 high-speed rail corridors, figure out a way to link them, and put together a 30-year vision, 25 or 30-year vision of a national high-speed rail network. We're going to need it. We're going to need it, you know, to be more fuel efficient, you know, move people, you know, help alleviate congestion in our major urban areas and on our highways. It's going to be expensive to build, but it'll have long-term benefits, and hey, look at the incredible cost of adding a lane mile to a freeway, particularly a freeway near an urban area. It's astronomical if you can do it. So the rail alternative is more and more imperative.
We're speaking with 4th District Congressman Peter DeFazio. Peter, is it reasonable to think our prison at Guantanamo holding enemy combatants will be closed anytime soon?
I support the president in his efforts to close it, and I'm a bit amused by the arguments that we just had this debate on the floor last week over the Homeland Security bill. The Republicans saying we're jeopardizing America because we might bring these accused terrorists here to the United States. And I said, you know, and they're worried they weren't on the no-fly list. I said, look, if they come to the United States, they're going to come in shackles and they're going to be transferred to a maximum security prison somewhere, and then we're going to put them into our judicial system. I'm not too worried about that threat. We've got people locked away in those prisons already who are really bad, the people who tried to blow up the World Trade Center back in the early 90s, you know, the Unabomber, all sorts of people. So I think it's realistic to move toward closure. I think it's imperative for our international reputation and relations. I think the president's doing a very good job there, and I was a little puzzled when the Senate slammed the door, so-called, in his face on that, and hopefully they will rethink their position.
You've said you don't favor cap and trade, an approach that has companies limiting, then buying and trading pollution credits. Why and what do you favor as an offset to global warming?
Well, look, Claude, we had a horrible problem in this country in the 50s and 60s with rivers like the Willamette being an open sewer. Rivers back east actually caught fire. Did we clean them up by selling pollution credits? Did we clean them up by involving Wall Street hedge funds and speculators and driving up the costs? No. We proposed, we went out and inventoried sources of pollution. We said to everybody, you've got to have a permit for that pollution. And by the way, here's your schedule to stop polluting. And by the way, if you don't meet the schedule, we are going to fine the heck out of you. And we cleaned up our rivers. We could do the same thing here. Jim McDermott from Washington State actually has a cap, regulate, and reduce bill. That would minimize costs, and it would give us maximum predictability in terms of a schedule, which is what the industry who are going to be impacted by this tell me they need. They need to know what are going to be the rules 5 years from today, 10 years from today, in terms of how much carbon they can emit. If you want to introduce maximum uncertainty and the maximum potential for market manipulation and cost, go with cap and trade. It's just like energy deregulation. Enron actually came up with the idea of cap and trade before they pulled their energy scam, drove up our energy costs, and bankrupted the company. This is an Enron idea. There are already hedge funds in Europe that sell carbon offsets in the third world. So in Europe today, you can pollute if you go to a hedge fund and buy a derivative product, which is theoretically based on someone planting trees in the Amazon basin or in India or somewhere else to offset your carbon in Europe. The Europeans have had their costs up $60 billion of trades over 06 and 07 in their carbon markets. And guess what? Their carbon emissions were higher. So consumers paid $60 billion more. Carbon emissions were up, and it worked. How did it work? Well, a few people get really filthy rich, just like Wall Street did on the financial scams, and that's what cap and trade's going to do. Wall Street loves the idea of cap and trade. They're already figuring out ways to game it. I've been pouring through this bill, trying to understand that 1,000-page bill. So far as I can tell, with what they've got in that bill, with between carbon offsets and all the free credits they're going to give away, we could probably increase our carbon emissions until at least 2030, and then begin, then they might begin to decline. That's the way this bill is designed. They bought off so many people to do it, and it was such a sketchy idea to begin with, it'll be a disaster.
Tell us about the 30,000-acre Devil's Staircase northeast of Reedsport, that wilderness area, and your plans to protect it.
Well, Devil's Staircase was first proposed to be part of the Omnibus Oregon Wilderness Bill back in 1984, the Jim Weaver's legislation. In negotiations, particularly with Senator Hatfield, Jim had to pare back a number of areas, and that was one that came out of the bill. It's a phenomenally wild and beautiful area. I went in there last fall. It's absolutely trailless.
On your hands and knees, I understand.
Yeah, well, that was coming out. It's very rugged. It's just spectacularly beautiful. We saw three or four very rare, we saw a giant lizard and we saw some really special frog. Just in a very short period of time, we saw a number of things that virtually you don't see anywhere else in addition to the big old trees and the seclusion. We got to Devil's Staircase, and we had gotten lost going in, which I guess is pretty normal, and had ended up in this ravine and bushwhacked through a bunch of blackberries and finally get to the stream. Then we found the staircase. And then they said to me, well, what do you want to do? You want to go back the way it came? I said, heck no, that was really bad. Let's go. I said, how about we go up above the falls and let's just go look at that slope there. We could go up. And they said, oh, yeah, well, we've never tried that. Let's try that. Well, that's where after we went a fairly short distance, we were ended up on our hands and knees going up for about a quarter of a mile, and then we ended up by a huge blowdown, and we had to climb up on top of the wood. It was wild. It was incredible. It definitely is a wilderness, and it should be protected for all time.
Well, let's take you out of one wilderness and take you into another. You've proposed a securities transaction fee to require Wall Street to finance its own bailout. What's its status?
it's still a great idea. I mean, we're putting all this on the taxpayers' dime. We're borrowing against future generations. That $700 billion borrowed for the Wall Street bailout. Heck, there are children not yet born who are going to be paying to repay that money 30 years from now. I think the securities transaction fee, something we had from 1916 until 1960, something that the Congress in the 30s had the guts to double. They said, oh, my God, we got all these reconstruction projects. The economy's in the tank. We've got to put people to work. We've got to build things. Let's double the securities transaction fee on Wall Street. People on Wall Street said the same thing then that they said about me. They said, oh, it'll destroy the market and it'll ruin capitalism and all this. Well, guess what? Nothing happened. The market only went up from that point on, and Congress collected a good amount of money. It's a very minuscule fee on trades. The one thing it would do, and the one valid criticism, is it would rein in people who trade on 1/100th of 1% margin every 2 seconds with a computer, day traders and people like that, speculators. Anybody who's investing, for any return that exceeds like 0.5% would still make money even after the transaction fee. Anybody who's holding the stock maybe as long as a day, gosh, I don't know, maybe even God forbid, maybe you want to hold it for 6 months, a year or two. Maybe it's really about investing and building things. I don't know, but it would rein in some speculation. That's the biggest criticism anybody has. And tell you what, I think that would be good.
Are you optimistic that it's going to pass?
There's actually some interest. I've actually had some interest from the White House. People are starting to get serious about the deficits here. The Blue Dogs were very excited about my idea last fall during the whole bailout debate until this woman named Laura Tyson came in and charmed them all and told them how the markets and the street wouldn't like it. Laura Tyson, a former economic advisor to Bill Clinton. Of course, Bill Clinton was responsible for the deregulation that created all this stuff. Republican Congress and Bill Clinton, repealed Glass-Steagall. They put in place the Commodity Futures Trading, Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Robert Rubin, his buddy, proposed that, we prohibit regulation of derivatives. So the seeds for this disaster were sent in the Clinton years, and they came back in last fall and rained on my transaction tax. I'm going to push it again as we look more and more into the maw of yawning deficits. It would be a responsible way to take care of part of that problem.
Will you be a candidate next year to succeed Governor Kulongoski?
I've, at the moment, totally immersed in trying to write an absolutely transformative surface transportation bill. This is a really big deal. I'm looking at trying to do something combined between modernizing our transportation system in the 21st century and high-speed rail, probably $500 billion of investment over 6 years, putting tens of millions of people to work and moving our economy forward. I hope to have that bill done, and at least out of my committee, in the next month. I have had some conversations with a number of people who would like to see me run for governor, and I'm going to continue those conversations and make a decision by the end of the summer. I've got a pretty good day job now. I'm getting some good stuff done, but Oregon needs a lot of work. We don't have a sustainable state system. I mean, when you can't educate your kids, when you can't maintain basic public safety, when you have the lowest corporate tax effort in the United States, so I think Mississippi's lower. This system needs a lot of work and reform, and someone's got to take that on. We'll see. I'll watch the field. I'll talk to people and make a decision later this year.
So the answer in one word is maybe. But how does the possible entry of former Governor Kitzhaber affect the race?
John and I have known each other for 30 years. We had a nice chat about 2 weeks ago, and he's looking at it. I'm looking at it. I'm bemused that he would be looking at it since when he left. And I said this to him, I kind of remember your exit speech, the state's ungovernable. And he said, well, some things have changed. And, I just told him I really, want to see someone there who's not, we're not going to go down the same path we've been going down. We need to look at the realities of modern state government. We haven't reformed it since the 60s, despite the fact that they're now paying for primary secondary education, mandatory prison sentences, prison, all this other stuff. We haven't reformed our tax system. We haven't reformed the function of the government itself. We need a governor who's going to tackle some of those big problems. And John says he's thinking about it, and I told him I was thinking about it, and we said we'd talk some more.
You're sure sounding like a candidate to me.
Well, I mean, I live in and love Oregon, Claude. I'm not a native. I came here.
You're also tired, I understand, of all this traveling back and forth.
Well, there is that. You know, I mean, I'm bumping up toward 4 million miles flown, and you know, it would be great to restrict my travels to one very large piece of territory and stay on the highway or on the train where I can, and do Oregon that way. So, you know, I am not making any declarations. I'm looking at it. I mean, I do enjoy the job I got now. It's a huge challenge, and with the Obama administration, it's more exciting than it's been, since early in the Clinton years before I kind of soured on him with NAFTA and his economic policies.
Shucks, I fully expected that you were going to declare your candidacy right here, right now. Last question on that topic. Do you expect Springfield's Republican Mayor Sid Lykin, who's filed to run for your seat, to present a significant challenge?
Well, he's very highly touted by the Republicans, just as was Jim Feldkamp before him. I think he's, you know, Sid starts out kind of in a world of hurt. You know, he attacked me for opposing the bailout. So if he's going to try and say I'm like a status quo Democrat throwing in with Nancy Pelosi, which is the standard Republican line, the problem would be he supported Nancy Pelosi and George Bush and Henry Paulson in bailing out Wall Street. Now, I think that's kind of the end of the campaign right there.
Thank you so much. Appreciate talking with you.
Okay. I always enjoy talking to you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.